Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. On the road, finishing up some important documentaries that hopefully I'll be able to share with you in the late spring or early summer. Today, we're going to talk about the latest in good bacteria from our health segment, mindfulness meditation, what it can do to turn off inflammation, and learning about trees and human health and how they're linked from the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. This is a very important study. Also, the National Institutes of Health links diet drinks to depression. For our guest today, we'll have two. One is a newsmaker, which is a shorter interview. She is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. We're going to talk about the American College of Physicians recommending a longer battery of vaccines for all healthcare workers. So for all nurses and orderlies and physicians and nurses' aides and physicians' aides, anyone working in a hospital setting or in a clinic, they're trying to mandate that not only you take the flu vaccine, but a whole rash of vaccines, vaccines that have very serious side effects. So I'll read the article, and then Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who is a medical doctor and has written extensively upon vaccines, will be on to debate the issue. Then my regular guest, talking about a challenge to the mantra that green capitalism or eco-capitalism is a solution against climate change, and a look at its failures and false promises. My guest will be Heather Rogers. She is an award-winning journalist and filmmaker and a senior staff reporter at Remapping Debate, an investigative reporting news site sponsored by the Anti-Discrimination Center with a mission to introduce alternative views to controversial public policy issues. And her work has been in the New York Times Magazine, Mother Jones, Utley Reader, and The Nation. And she has a couple good books, including Green Going Wrong, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Eco-Capitalism. Also today, time permitting, because we have a packed show, 10 Things Science Taught Us About Happiness from Jason Marsh and Laura Klein and Jeremy Adam Smith from GreaterGood.Berkeley. Obama's Steady Road to Austerity by Glenn Ford. This I'm definitely going to do. We're taking on a lot of issues. Let's begin. First off, as you know if you've listened to this program, good bacteria helps contribute to good health. And in some cultures, they thrive on good bacteria. The Japanese culture, the Chinese culture, the South Korean culture, because they have a lot of fermented foods. And fermented foods can ferment for long periods of time. Miso can ferment for years. And I didn't know when I first began to consume fermented foods that it was something other than soy paste. Now it's virtually every grain can be fermented to make a form of miso. You can have barley, for example, and rice. And it has different textures and qualities. And I like it milder. Some people like it stronger. But you can also, if you're in Germany, a lot of people in Germany drink sauerkraut juice, and that's very good for you because it's also loaded with good bacteria. It also has a nutrient that will help heal H. pylori and ulcers in the stomach. It's terrific for you. For those who don't want the sodium, you could have raw cabbage juice. For those that live in other cultures where they use kefir, kefir is very rich in good probiotics. So no matter what the source of probiotic, or just taking a supplement each day, you need them. I suggest between, at the low end, at the very low end, a billion, but more idealistically, up around 10 to 20 billion. Mainstream science is catching up. This is from Science Daily. And it's based upon the peer-reviewed journal Science. Quote, early life exposure to normal bacteria of the GI tract, the the gut microbes, protects against autoimmune disease in mice, according to research published in Science. The study may also have uncovered reasons why females are at greater risk of autoimmune disease, such as multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus, compared to males. Researchers from the Hospital for Sick Children found that when female mice at high risk of autoimmune type 1 diabetes were exposed to normal gut bacteria from adult male mice, they were strongly protected against the disease. And then it goes on to talk about why. And the bottom line is, the more good bacteria you have, the stronger your immune system, and that means less likelihood of having immune-related illnesses. Well, how about cancer then? Cancer is a very powerful immune-related illness. How about allergies? So where they take a mono study, and I say if it's going to help the immune system of mice and of humans, why not help the immune system of people with allergies? So in my own experience with working with lots of people, tens of thousands, those who talk about having chronic allergies, one of the first things you do, you build up their immune system. You load the body with probiotics 3 times a day, and you eliminate any sugars, any refined carbohydrates, anything that feeds bad bacteria, and promote everything that is good bacteria. And a strong individual use is wheatgrass juice, generally starting with 1 ounce a day in the morning on an empty stomach. But over a month, building it up to where you're having it 3 times a day. And again, only at an ounce. You can go to higher doses once your body acclimates and you get used to it. But wheatgrass juice and probiotics, the two together, terrific for people with allergies, arthritis, digestive disorders, and cancer. Mindfulness meditation may relieve chronic inflammation. This is a major study, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Brain Behavior and Immunity. And here's what it says. I'll quote from it. People suffering from chronic inflammatory conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, and asthma, in which psychological stress plays a major role, may benefit from mindful meditation techniques. This was done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and neuroscientists with the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the Weissman Center. Now, for this audience, you know that mindfulness meditation helps reduce stress. It also helps reduce pain. And what you do is you focus consistently upon your breath. You just sit still and you breathe. In fact, an easy way of doing it, if you have pain anywhere in your body, and you could try it right now, put one hand on your gently on your belly and one hand on your chest. Now, we don't actually breathe through our belly. And we don't really, even though we say diaphragmatic breathing, what we do is we breathe through our lungs, our 2 lungs, but most people don't breathe through even 50% of their lungs. Even yoga teachers don't use all of their lung power. Athletes have to use as much lung power as possible because the oxygen is a direct relationship, has a direct relationship to creating energy and the stimulation of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and your mitochondria, your energy factories, being able to flash, just like spark plugs and pistons in a car. But for this exercise, what we do, we want to try to bring the air deeper into the lungs, and hence, we don't want oxygen debt, meaning we are needing more oxygen than what we're breathing in, so we have a debt. Most people, unfortunately, they do short throat breathing. Not good. Much better, deep breathing, what we call diaphragmatic breathing. Because the bottom lobes of the lung, when you're lying down, are right where you're in alignment with your diaphragm, but higher. So what you do, you put your hand on your belly, and as you breathe, try to force your hand on your belly up. And as long as you keep inhaling slowly and get your hand up, then secondly, now bring your hand on your chest up, meaning breathe deep, then breathe deep again. So the hand on the belly goes up, then the hand on the chest goes up, then let that air out of the lower hand, air out of the higher hand. In effect, and with always a little force at the end, like, so you breathe in through the mouth and nose, and then you exhale, and a little stronger at the end, so you expel that extra air, and hence carbon dioxide. That creates a focus upon your breathing. And after about 60 seconds of doing that, the mindfulness of doing it calms you down and helps ease pain. And this study talks about that. So if you want to feel better and reduce inflammation throughout the body, mindful meditation and deep breathing can do it. When I'm flying to get from point A to point B, especially when I have to go out to Oregon or Canada or someplace, I am always grateful when I can see down and see the landscape. And I'm seeing that area of the country that's green and wooded and how much woods exist down there. And I always love to go where there are trees. I think most people do. I believe that based upon the epigenetics of natural consciousness, we are meant to be around grass and trees and flowers, rivers and streams and brooks and oceans and mountains and desert. We have to be with nature. And that's one of the reasons that we look forward to our vacation. If it's hanging out on a beach in the Caribbean, great. If it's in a eco rainforest down in Belize or one of the countries, good. Or one of the high camps up in the Sierras, also excellent. Here's what the science community says now. This is from the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, and it says, evidence is increasing from multiple scientific fields that exposure to the natural environment can improve human health. In this study by the U.S. Forest Service, the presence of trees was associated with better health. For Jeffrey Donovan, a research forester at the Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station, and his colleagues, the loss of 100 million trees in the eastern and midwestern United States was an unprecedented opportunity to study the impact of a major change in the natural environment on human health. So what they did is this really neat study. They analyzed 18 years of data on 1,298 counties in 15 states. The researchers found that Americans living in areas infested by the emerald ash borer, a beetle that kills ash trees, suffered from an additional 15,000 deaths from cardiovascular disease and 6,000 more deaths from lower respiratory disease when compared to uninfected areas. When emerald ash borer comes into a community, city, or state, and then in your town, the trees become barren and they die. The researchers analyzed demographic and human mortality and a lot of other data, and they found that it was the lack of trees, not income, not race, education, that influences. It was about trees. Quote, there's a natural tendency to see our findings and conclude that surely the higher death rates are because of some confounding variable like income or education and not the loss of trees. But we saw the same pattern repeated over and over in counties with very different demographic makeups. So this is remarkable. Now just imagine what you feel like when you go to Central Park if you live in New York, or when I was just down in Washington a few weeks ago, I took a moment and asked the person drive me, could we drive around, the Potomac area? I wanted to see the Potomac River And I love going to Mount Vernon. It's one of my favorite places to visit. I like to feel the energy of old estates and old homes. And just being that close to the city, but also being where there's nature, very soothing, very enlivening. And now imagine walking up the Upper West Side, where I live and where my office is, in Manhattan. And I was noticing this as I was walking on Amsterdam, and some of the better vegan restaurants in New York are on Amsterdam, including Manna, which is one of my favorites, and some of the others, a Peace Cafe, Candle Cafe. There's all within a short walking distance, one to another. I was looking at all the garbage bags on the left-hand side by the street, and the stench, and the cracked sidewalks, and the ugliness of the buildings, the unkeptness, the dirt, the grime. One restaurant I walked by, all of the tables and the canopy over them was really tattered. But they're the people enjoying themselves. Good for them. But oblivious to their environment. They had adapted to it. And then when I had to go down to do some filming in Miami and also to make a presentation, I took the opportunity to jump over for an hour to South Beach and to walk down Lincoln Road. Now, if you've never been on Lincoln Road, it runs about 7 or 8 blocks. There's no traffic allowed on it. And there's wonderful shops, and there's like running down the center of it are different types of flora and fauna. It's clean. It's beautiful. There are restaurants of all types and shops and music and theaters. And the energy is just the finest you could find, in my opinion, in the United States. Now, I've been everywhere in the United States, and there's nothing to compare it to. And again, it's if you took away all that nature, if you took away the palm trees at the end and down through it, if you took away everything and just left the shops, then no big deal. And it just reminded me of how important trees are and how what happens when you don't have them. One more reason that I believe that we have to spend more time in nature. And finally, 260,000 adults were researched over a 10-year period. And what they found is this, through the National Institutes of Health, that those who consume the highest amount of soft drinks had the highest level of depression. In fact, it was substantially higher. And so, unfortunately, people rarely think about depression in soft drinks. So, quote, our research suggests that cutting out or down on sweetened drinks or replacing them with unsweetened will naturally help lower your depression risks, end quote. Well, what's in a soft drink that could cause you to be depressed? How about a lot of fructose that can adversely affect your blood sugar level, spiking it up and bringing it down, and affecting hormones? Now, if they had green tea drinks, that wouldn't have happened. They would have felt better. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with our newsmaker. Please stay with us. This is from the Alliance for Natural Health, and they talk about the flu epidemic. The numbers just don't add up, and I'll quote them. This is short, but I think relevant to what my guest is going to discuss and what many of us are fully aware of. Should the government be recommending mercury-containing flu shots to everyone, especially if they are useless for 97.5% of adults? One prominent media outlet says, influenza has reached epidemic proportions in the United States with 7.3% of deaths last week caused by pneumonia and the flu. According to CDC, another report released the same day says that despite all these news reports about overcrowded emergency rooms, it's too soon to say whether it will be worse than normal. And quoted, the CDC as saying the number of states reporting high levels of flu activity had actually dropped from 29 to 24. A third wonders why fewer than 65% of Americans got a flu shot this year, while a fourth states that flu vaccine is only about 62% effective, meaning that over a third of the people who do get flu shots still get the flu. But that 62% figure is misleading. There are currently three different epidemics hitting the U.S. True, influenza type A, type B, or seasonal H1N1 influenza. Norovirus, stomach flu, and whooping cough, according to a meta-analysis published in the weekly peer-reviewed journal The Lancet. The flu vaccine is only 62% effective in preventing type A or B influenza or seasonal influenza. It doesn't protect at all against norovirus and whooping cough. In other words, only 2.7% of all adults get type A or B or H1N1 influenza. And of them, the vaccine will fail 38% of the time, which means it really benefits only about 1.8% of the population. Moreover, even preventing traditional influenza depends upon the government guessing correctly well in advance about which strains will be a problem in the coming season. This year they got two influenza strains right, but missed one. In addition, there is no evidence that the flu vaccine provides any protection whatsoever for adults 65 or over, even though the elderly are one of the flu vaccine campaign's target population. To top it off, the effectiveness of the whooping cough vaccine drops as time passes. A study found that the effectiveness fell from 98.1% within a year of completion of the vaccine regimen to 71% 5 or more years later, and even that figure is doubtful by some scientists. As we noted 2 years ago, the CDC's figures are fabricated or false. It's as if they're saying, well, we really have no idea what the truth is, so we just make stuff up. Could it have something to do with the cozy relationship between pharmaceutical companies, regulators, and the media? Last October, we told you about that the flu shot being forced on healthcare workers. But it's gotten even worse. Hospitals are incentivized to vaccinate their staff in order to receive favorable treatment under Medicare reimbursements. The Affordable Care Act established hospital value-based purchasing, which offers payment reductions if the hospital meets certain government-determined performance standards, and this often includes flu vaccinations for its healthcare workers. But if the vast majority of healthcare workers who do receive the mandatory flu vaccine will get the flu anyway, how does that really help the overall health of the staff? In light of this, it becomes obvious that mandatory flu vaccination policies are financially driven and not patient safety driven. The problem is that some of the best healthcare workers choose not to vaccinate because they recognize the shot's ineffectiveness, not to mention its risks, even at the threat of being fired. How absurd is it that the government is continuing to push the flu vaccine when the shot is proving ineffective against the majority of current flu cases, and when there is a shortage of vaccine anyway? Well, of course, Dr. Jonathan Wright of the Townsend Letter recommends the best advice, skip the flu shot, he says. Build up your immunity instead with vitamin C, vitamin D, and if you become infected, take vitamin A, real vitamin A, not beta-carotene, and use other tried-and-true natural remedies, end quote. Last week, Richard Gale and myself wrote a very comprehensive 9-page article on the flu vaccine. We did not write about its toxicity, and its adjuvants. Instead, we wrote just about its effectiveness, using only the peer-reviewed literature. It is posted on ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com, GaryNall.com, and my Facebook. In it, we show that they do not have the science on their side using their statistics. They have a propaganda campaign, and they know how to control the Google search engines, so anyone looking for anything on the flu always go to their sites. So my suggestion is today, please look at, read the article, and if you agree with its outcome, and it's all of its statements are fully referenced and cited, then pass it on. Send it out. Get it out to as many people in the universe as you can in the internet universe, because hopefully then more people will read it and have some counterbalancing opinion. Now let's go to my guest who is standing by, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. I gave you her background at the beginning of the program, and she's on the phone with us now. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be here. Thank you so much.
Let me read this to you, because I want to discuss several issues, and I just want you to roll through them uninterrupted, all right? The American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that thimerosal remain in vaccines. And by the way, I wrote a whole piece on thimerosal, and I interviewed toxicologist, and I looked at the toxicological data, and I even looked at what the American Academy of Pediatrics originally recommended, remove all mercury, back in the early 1990s from vaccines. Now they have reversed themselves. They want to put mercury back into all the vaccines. I'd like for you to address that. Then, more important would be the press release from the American College of Physicians website recommending that all healthcare workers receive a long list of vaccines. Let me just quote that. Quote, Philadelphia, American College of Physicians calls for immunizations of all healthcare providers and recommends they get immunized against influenza, diphtheria, hepatitis B, measles, mumps, and rubella, pertussis, and varicella. And according to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, adult immunization schedule, that they should have all these right away. First, and now it's over to you, but first, I would like for you to address this common refrain. Immunization against, is there scientific peer review, gold standard, double-blind placebo-controlled studies that prove that when you're vaccinated, you're immunized? Because if you're vaccinated and it does not impart immunity on every single individual, then the entire construct, the entire paradigm is faulty. Let's begin there.
That's a great place to start, Gary, because from the time I started doing vaccine educational seminars, which would have been back in probably March of 2001, one of the very first slides in my slide deck says, vaccination is not immunization. That by definition, vaccination is the injection, is the act of injecting something into someone. Immunization is the act of developing true immunity, but all vaccination really does is develop an antibody, which there is a lot of medical literature that shows that the antibody doesn't do anything other than be a marker of exposure. Because we know of many cases now, and I know you've talked about it, you've done documentaries about it, of children and adults who've been fully vaccinated, they have developed an antibody, and that they still become sick with whatever the disease is, whether it's influenza, pertussis, mumps, measles, and the list goes on and on. So the presence of an antibody, all it does is it represents an exposure, a contamination, we might want to call it that. So even in the medical scientific literature, when they talk about a study being done that shows that the vaccine showed efficacy. Efficacy to your ears and my ears and probably most of your listeners' ears would mean that I got a shot and it is effective in keeping me from getting sick. But truly, there's a different definition for the word efficacy in the scientific research, which means that I've injected you with something and I can draw your blood and I can document that you have an antibody. So the vaccine did what it was supposed to do. Yes, it was effective in developing this antibody against all of this contamination that's just been injected into the body that the body's trying to get rid of. But does that translate into being protective against getting an illness? And the answer to that is no. And in the other reason that we know it's a no is because you can't really prove a negative, meaning that if I got a shot, let's say a flu shot, and I did not get sick, does that mean it was because of the flu shot? Does that mean I really wasn't exposed to the virus? Does that mean that my immune system and the state of my general health overall is strong enough that I resisted this pathogen that I may or may not have come in contact with? So there are a lot of unknowns that we have uncovered in our research and continually tell listeners and readers about this. But the vaccine industry continues with its same march to the magic drummer of saying, we will vaccinate you with everything and that we will create these antibodies, and that is, and that our number one goal is just to vaccinate. Which brings to the point about what you said of this new press release from the American College of Physicians, that all healthcare workers will now receive all of these vaccines. Chances are that the vast majority of those healthcare workers received most of those vaccines in their childhood, particularly the younger ones, the ones in their 20s and their 30s. Many of them received additional doses of these vaccines when they went into college or when they went into their internship or their training programs. So to say that we need to revaccinate everyone, I hope that those people who cannot afford to lose their jobs and to quit healthcare and go find another way to make a living, that they will at least get a blood test done for something that's called a vaccine titer, which demonstrates the fact that those antibodies are present. And as far as the healthcare industry is concerned, and as far as the vaccine industry is concerned, that's all they care about, is whether or not that antibody is there, not whether or not it keeps you from getting sick or keeps you from transmitting things to other people. That's just a ruse. What they really want to know is whether or not you have that antibody. So I hope that they can go to my website, which is drtenpenny.com. There's a tab at the top that says titers, spelled T-I-T-E-R-S, titers. There's a drop-down window. You can order those directly from my website, or you can go to your doctor, you can go to Quest, or you can go to Direct Labs. There are lots of places where you can get those tests done. Because I'm really wondering, what is the overall motive behind this? Why has there been any reports, none that I've seen, and Gary, you do even more research than I do, but I have never seen any reports where these unvaccinated or dirty little healthcare workers, as they would say, are spreading measles, mumps, rubella, chicken pox, diphtheria, tetanus, whooping cough, all of these things back to patients. Do we have any reason to be concerned that patients who are in the hospital sitting are getting sick because of exposure to their doctors and nurses and other people taking care of them?
Even though we know that in the hospital system, we have
the largest number of people get infections, but they are not vaccine-preventable disease infections.
That's what I was just going to say. I'm up to date on the latest statistics, and it's over 80,000 dead Americans because of infections from unsanitary hands and non-sterilized equipment, and including MRSA. But none of the healthcare workers has been spreading other contaminated viruses around a hospital. So there's no need for this, even if it could be proven it works. My final question for you, in the light of the current flu madness, where everyone is being told to get a flu shot, why has there been virtually no emphasis placed upon prevention or natural approaches?
You know, it's because they're not patentable, and the pharmaceutical industry is not going to make billions off of that. And so something as simple as washing your hands, or if you're a healthcare worker, washing your stethoscope as you go from patient to patient in the hospital. Vitamin C, high doses of vitamin D, which I'm sure you've talked about a lot. I mean, all kinds of things that you can do to keep yourself healthy, because health is an inside-out phenomenon. It's about what you eat, the exercise you do, the water you drink, the sleep that you get. It's about keeping your body healthy from the inside out. Health cannot be obtained through some sort of a vaccination or some sort of an injection. It just doesn't work that way. And so you're absolutely right. There are lots of other things that people can do to remain healthy and stay healthy. And the number one thing that people should try to do is to avoid the flu shot no matter what.
We appreciate you giving us these insights. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Gary. You have a great afternoon.
Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, Tenpenny. And she is the author of, several books. She has a recent DVD, Flu and Flu Vaccines, and also Fowl, Bird Flu, It Is Not What You Think, and Saying No to Vaccines. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. To present a commentary, short commentary from Glenn Ford from blackagendareport.com. Glenn originates a program in our studios, and he is a very conscientious person. Here's his commentary entitled Obama's Steady Road to Austerity. Barack Obama's second swearing in as president will not produce anything approaching the awesome pilgrimage, the great black hallelujah, that swarmed around him on January 20, 2009. Most African Americans experienced the last inauguration as a new beginning, a collective grabbing of the gold ring, a fantasia on the National Mall. Few caught the meaning of his coded messages of impending austerity, a careful telegraphing of his intentions to gut Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs. Quote, our time of standing pat, of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time is surely past, end quote. The new president told the tearfully joyous throng, only a handful of whom understood that the narrow interest he referred to was them, and that Obama had already made the unpleasant decision to launch an all-out assault on the societal safety net. Not that his plans were a secret. In the preceding weeks, Obama had informed the editorial boards of the New York Times and the Washington Post that entitlement reform, the Republican code word for cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, was high on his agenda. But black folks were so transfixed on the miracle of the first black president, most failed to comprehend simple English. Obama had already made the unpleasant decision to launch an all-out assault on the social safety net. 4 years later, it is impossible not to hear the tolling of the bell. As early as mid-February, the pending debt ceiling impasse will provide another opportunity to take the axe to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Only fools believe that Obama will resist the impulse, since to do so would be to repudiate his entire first term in office. With methodical calculation, Obama laid the groundwork for a grand austerity bargain, beginning with his hand-picked Simpson-Bowes Deficit Reduction Commission. The so-called fiscal cliff was a trap set jointly by Obama and the GOP in the summer of 2011 after their deal for $4 trillion in cuts foundered on the issue of modest tax increases on the rich. With this month's agreement to make Bush's tax cuts permanent for 98% of the public, Obama and the Republicans' positions are closer than ever. All that is required for Obama to achieve his true legacy, to drive a stake into the heart of what's left of social welfare in the United States, is to marginalize hardcore Tea Party budget purists and, much more importantly, bludgeon the left wing of the Democrats into line, which has always been Obama's job in the corporate political division of labor. The odds are that Obama and his Republican tag teammates will triumph. In many ways, they already have. By embracing the notion that the deficit is the nation's number one problem, Obama has firmly embedded the logic of austerity, which is the logic of Wall Street, into Democratic Party politics. No wonder the Democratic Leadership Council folded in 2011. Having served as the party's corporate center of gravity since its founding by Bill Clinton, Al Gore, and other white, largely Southern Democrats in the 80s to blunt black and union influence, and the DLC's mission has been completed by the black Democrat, who first came to my attention when I found his name on the DLC's membership in the summer of 2003. Obama has firmly embedded the logic of austerity, which is the logic of Wall Street, into the Democratic Party politics, end quote. The imminent joy of Obama's grand bargain was on display for all to see in last year's first presidential debate, as Maya Rockenmoore, the brilliant young black political scientist who heads up Global Policy Solutions, points out in this week's edition of Black Agenda Radio. Quote, I think the president did not make a Freudian slip when he said that he and Mitt Romney actually agree on Social Security. The notion that Obama would turn left in his second term is nonsense, says Rockenmoore, an expert on entitlements. The reality is the first term Obama is the second term Obama. That is his disposition. That is his ideology. That is where he is at. He is a centrist to his heart. In conclusion, actually, he's a center-right Democrat who has positioned himself at the pivot of Wall Street's political project. Even the New York Times' David Sanger recognized Obama's true orientation back in late November 2008 as the president-elect was assembling his cabinet. Sanger meant it as a kind of a compliment on his choice of advisors, which suggested that Mr. Obama is planning to govern from the center-right of his party, surrounding himself with pragmatists rather than ideologues. At his first inauguration, Obama chastised Americans who are, quote, our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age. He was making the case for cuts of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, a choice that 80% of Americans and virtually the total black American community reject. But for Obama, then and now, the popular will is nothing but worn-out dogmas that are far too long have strangled our politics. Wall Street's choices are all that counts. So, who won the election? And why should black folks regard the outcome as kind of a collective victory? What bullet did we dodge? End quote. Obama's Steady Road to Austerity, commentary by Glenn Ford. Now to my guest who is standing by. And want to get into this topic. She is Heather Rogers. I've given you her background earlier in the show. Let me welcome her now. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Gary. How you doing?
Good. Heather, I'm going to let you run with this. I just want to take a look at capitalism, basically the idea that in order for humanity to be sustained and carried on throughout the future generations, there needs to be a constant growth between seller and buyer, and then a trade system that will strengthen this exchange without hindrance. It is strictly impersonal and in and of itself ethically neutral. And then we introduce the threats of life on the planet, our environment and cultures due to climate change and global warming. And we know solutions are needed to either lessen climate change's impact or to prepare ourselves when it gets much worse. And since our entire economic model is based upon consumer capitalism, and it seems to be the only thing modern societies in the 21st century know, we therefore try to find green solutions within the capitalist paradigm. So, begin first with why you feel the capitalist system and logic is unsuited for addressing ecological crisis, and what are the long-term consequences of trying to create a green or eco-capitalism, and who would you list as among the major culprits in promoting the false promise of green capitalism? The forum is yours.
Okay. Well, first, thanks a lot for having me on your show. And the question is really important because environmental problems that we're facing now are really something that we can't avoid. You know, they're happening whether we want them to or not. And they affect people all over the world. So what we do here has ramifications globally. Now, in terms of capitalism, the way that it works, the fundamental logic of it, is that it's a system that must grow. And so if it, you know, when it's not growing, it falls into crisis. And we've seen that, we've seen that with the economic crises in Europe and the U.S. And earlier you had a commentary that was talking about austerity. When the economy can't grow, it really does create major problems, shortages of jobs and investment, money, and all that type of thing. So where does the growth come from? The growth comes from, among other things, exploiting natural resources, so extracting oil from the ground and trees from the forests and water, you know, using fresh water and all of these resources that contribute to the production of commodities, which are then distributed and sold and consumed and then many of them end up as garbage. And all of that has a tremendous impact on the environment. And so if we continue to see the environment as what a lot of people refer to as a source of raw materials for economic growth and expansion and production, and as a sink for the waste of that whole consumer-based system, then we will continue to see the kind of pollution and decline that we currently are living with, and that includes greenhouse gas emissions, especially carbon dioxide, you know, not to mention the melting of the ice caps and pollution, other kinds of pollution of the atmosphere and water and soil. So there are a whole range of effects, not just global warming. So if we have a system that has to grow and it relies on the extraction and contamination of nature, then how is it that that system, you know, that has to produce ever more products and sell ever more commodities in order to keep going and to stay healthy and to employ people, if that system needs the environment the way that it does, how is it ever going to solve the problems of, for example, global warming, climate change? How is it going to create solutions that actually work? And what I look at in Green Gone Wrong is a number of solutions like organic food and biofuels and green vehicles, carbon offsets, those types of consumer-oriented, quote-unquote, solutions to try to address these problems. And what I found over and over again was that they aren't effective. They might make some improvements, and that's good, but in terms of solving the problem on a fundamental level, they don't work. And they don't work because they continue to be based on this logic of growth.
Good. Let's be specific. Let's look at hybrid cars and biofuels and Walmart and Whole Foods selling organic produce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, for example, with organic food, one of the things that happens is you have this boom in farmers markets and consuming local organic food. It's become very fashionable and popular. And one thing that never gets talked about is that those small farmers have a very hard time earning a living. So there is a gap in, you know, we're paying, I write about a farmer in my book who sells eggs for $14 a dozen, and some of his greens go for over $40 a pound, and he still has financial problems because the land required to do the farming, to sell in places, I live in New York City, to sell in places like New York City where this farmer sells, the land that they have to farm is so expensive, the taxes are expensive, and they don't get any kind of supports or fundamental, help with marketing and coordination of distribution and things like that that conventional farmers get. So there are a whole host of reasons why it's economically very hard for them. I think it's important to point that out. And then in terms of, because they're touted as these sort of heroes, but really if we want that to happen, we need to pay attention to their economic situation. Then in terms of larger scale organic, the U.S. only has 7% of all the organic cropland in the world. And the organic market is growing, has been growing by double digits every year for the last decade. So there's this huge surge in demand. Well, where's that food going to come from? Especially when you have big players like Whole Foods and Walmart, General Mills getting in on the game. They have to go overseas to get the organic food that they use in their products. And they're going increasingly to places like China and Chile. And in the book I went to, for the book, I went to Paraguay, which is the world's number one, or the U.S. is the number one producer of organic sugar that's sold in the U.S. They produce about a third of all the organic sugar sold in the U.S. And what's happening there is not what people expect when they see the organic label. What's happening there is that this sugar plantation that I visited, instead of converting its existing cropland to organic, they're clearing native forest in order to expand their organic cropland. So, you know, that is not what people are looking for, and I don't think that's what people believe they're getting when they look for the seal, the USDA organic seal. And what we see is, instead of organic transforming the industrial food system, what we see is the industrial food system transforming what is organic.
Well said. I appreciate that. I've been asking this audience to boycott the organic foods in Walmart, boycott Whole Foods, and boycott carbon offsets. They're stupid and they don't work. And also biofuels, which pollute the environment and take good cropland away, or land that can be used to grow food, locally supplied and locally provided to the inhabitants. And we just don't think, we don't look. And so I'm glad that you brought to our attention that it was only a matter of time before the Wall Street and hedge fund and equity partnership, the big players, began to see the enormous economic advantage of controlling the green movements and the vehicles and the products that it creates. And so you've given us a heads up, and I appreciate it. Any final thoughts, please?
Just that, you know, in terms of solutions, in the book I do talk a lot about solutions, and one of the most important points is, I think that we need to think about how do we separate growth from development, from a good standard of living? How do we start to reconceptualize economic models so that we can have a different kind of living, so that it's not based on, you know, the capitalist logic, but what other forms can we imagine? And there are lots of people doing this work, and I do talk about it in the book, and we need to spend a lot of time and a lot of energy experimenting and researching and trying new things and making things that actually work.
I agree. Thank you very much, Heather Rogers.
Thanks,
for coming on. Her book is Green Going Wrong, and her website, what's your website, Heather?
It's heatherrogers.info.
All the best to you.
Thank you. You too.
I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow or our next program. Now let's say hello to our callback segment. Your time, your opportunity to call in and share your points of view on any of the things we discussed. And at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Let me also mention that on Sunday, At noon, we'll be having our final get-together for those who would like to be considered for a homesteading project. And it's not a lecture on homesteading. It's those who are ready to change their lives and do homesteading. You'll have to call 646-926-5422 to be able to get in, because our last two have been packed, and this one will also. It'll be at noon in Manhattan at our offices. Let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I actually was going to make that announcement, too, but I wonder if we can start at 12:30 instead of at 12.
Sure.
Yeah, so we have a couple of people already signed up, and do you have the number for them to call? Should they want to?
I gave it already, 646-926-5422.
Very good. Yeah, that's basically what I want to do today. And really just give a big thank you from many members of your audience who are now, they're really learning about vaccines, listening to your guests carefully. I'm getting a lot of emails from people thanking me. I had a woman just call me this morning. Her child got an 8-year-old, a total of now 24 vaccines, and now the child has severe muscle twitching and cramping such that he can't even function in school. And they just don't attribute any of it to vaccines. Well, she's going to be getting involved with the vaccine attorney next, because this is just horrific what we're doing to our kids. So thank you from your audience for all of the work that you're doing against vaccines.
Good. Well, we appreciate it. I have a lot to go on. Sunday night is our talkback hour. I'm going to be sharing a lot on that. Then on Monday, I'm going to talk about the issues that we can learn from science about human nature. I'm going to talk about that on Monday. Also, the latest on climate change, when we're becoming drier, hotter, and more disaster prone, what should we be doing? I'll talk about that as well. I have a lot to go over. Look forward to sharing with everyone. I'm off to do a lot of filming now, and so you'll have a wonderful weekend. Let's say hello to Utrice Lee, who's standing by. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today it's about polls and PR and power. Oh, my.
Well, that's original.
You know, it's Friday. That's where I am. But it's, we talk about how our minds are messed with by professionals whose job it is to mess up our minds.
Yes, well, we know who started all that in an official way, don't we? Edward Bernays.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who figured out how to get people to buy what they don't need, spend what they don't have, and then when they get angry and depressed, what drug to take, which is just continuing the cycle.
Yes, indeedy.
Have a great show.
Thank you.
Utrice Lead, right now on the Progressive Radio Network. And by the way, for all of you who may not be aware of it, there are about 43,000 internet radio stations. We have been number one now for 2 weeks. We were number two for years. And also number one listened to out of 4,000 on the telephone. We just thank you, because every day an average of 4,500 brand new young listeners are coming 7 days a week. You add that up, that's a lot of new people bringing in ideas, sharing them. And it's about people sharing. We have to look at we. It's all about we working together. Every single person that shares something of a positive nature that empowers another person is contributing to we going forward in a positive way. That's how I see it. And I want to thank you for joining with us to share the ideas of over 80 hosts, with the articles, the documentaries of so many, from Danny Schechter, Michio Kaku, and Helen Colicott, and Richard Martin. Whole lot of good people care about you. They really care about you. And they put themselves on the line to make sure that every time they come on the air, they're giving you something that empowers you, that improves the quality of our awareness and our lives. And you're passing it on to other people. And I see that, and I commend you for that. It's never about one. It's always about all of us working together. Have a nice day.